episode of the Benefits Brief is sponsored by Humana. As healthcare costs continue to rise in the group Medicare market, Humana is helping employers and plan sponsors improve outcomes through value-based care, prevention, and smarter clinical strategies. But what's really driving those rising costs, and what can benefits professionals do to help clients get ahead of them? Let's get briefed.
This is the Benefits Brief, the official podcast of the National Association of Benefits and Insurance Professionals. Your fast track to what you need to know to stay sharp, informed, and ready to deliver for your clients. And now, here's your host, former NABIP president and award-winning podcaster, David Saltzman.
And our guest on this episode of the Benefits Brief is Dr. Rebecca Colon, who is the Chief Medical Officer for Humana's Group Medicare Division, where she leads clinical strategy, population health initiatives, and health plan management. With more than a decade of physician leadership experience and more than 12 years at Humana, she brings both the clinical and business perspectives to one of our industry's biggest challenges. Dr. Colon, welcome to the Benefits Brief.
Thank you so much for having me, David.
It's our pleasure. Let's just dive right in. Healthcare costs, as we all know, continue to rise every year. From your perspective, what are the biggest forces that are driving those increases in the group Medicare market?
So, David, it really comes down to two main drivers.
First off, healthcare services today are costing more. We're seeing unit cost increases, providers, hospitals, and our drugs are costing more today. We've seen about an increase in prices for hospital and related services of nearly 8%. And the second driver is utilization has increased. We've seen that a steadily increase after COVID, and members are moving, using more services. We've seen an increase in behavioral health services. We see an increase in hospitalizations, surgical services, as well as outpatient services. And so it's really both components of that unit cost increase and that utilization that are driving increase. If we don't create cost mitigating strategies, that would be worse. Right now, we're running 7.7%. We would expect to be running closer to 9% if we weren't managing this closer.
Is there any one of those drivers in particular that really concerns you over the next 5 years?
I think the biggest concern that I have is in the prescription drug space and trying to ensure that we're better managing that. There's a lot of new therapies that come out. There's a lot of new opportunities for pharmaceuticals in the pharmaceutical space for different treatments. So that is one area where, you know, we're working to come up with ways to help better manage costs.
Are you doing anything in the area? I know a new emerging thing is what they're calling precision medicine, with combining pharmacogenomic testing with especially high-cost medications. Is that anything that you folks are playing with yet?
We do have a couple areas that we're looking at or that we're experimenting with outside of what's covered with Medicare. We have a couple of our plan sponsors that are very interested in that space. And they actually are investing in their membership, learning into that pharmacogenetics space to see what treatments would actually work better
for their members. So yes, there is some work being done in that space.
Do you expect cost trends to continue, or are there some reasons out there to be optimistic?
You know, I think there are some reasons to be optimistic, and a lot of it is because we're really looking for new sustainable strategies to help with in the cost space. You know, some of the things that we're doing to try to mitigate that is utilizing value-based care and focusing on that. We know that in value-based care, we see better outcomes, better clinical outcomes, because we're focused on quality. We also want to really continue to focus on prevention. And this has been something that we've been focused on for quite some time, but every year we're just pushing harder to ensure that our members are getting preventative care services that they need earlier. Also, there's some interesting cost containment strategies in the pharmacy space. as well as innovation in the virtual care space that we're utilizing, especially for those areas that are a little bit harder to reach, the rural settings and such. And that virtual care space and specialization in that space is growing.
You know, those are all great things. And some of them are things that really only carriers can kind of get their arms around. Are there things that plan sponsors should begin looking at if they want to help control costs without reducing quality of care?
I think they need to ask the plans, what are you all doing to help? And then from a plan sponsor perspective, support efforts to get out and communicate about preventative strategies to your population. So work with Humana on trying to, you know, entice the members to go get their preventative services, you know, whether it's annual wellness visits or mammograms or colon cancer screenings. You know, there's ways to incentivize members to engage in that care, to get their annual wellness visit with their primary care doctor and make sure that they have that. It is a very valuable tool. And a lot of times if the plan reaches out, they may not want to engage. But if they hear from their plan sponsor about the value that it brings, it does create some weight and create some traction for the retirees.
What are some of the big mistakes that you see employers making?
I don't know that I would say, I would think not necessarily engaging with the membership is a mistake. So some plan sponsors are really more hands-off. You know, they communicate with their membership once a year. I think it's a great idea to have more frequent communication, whether it's maybe a quarterly newsletter or utilizing social media posts to remind people about prevention or healthy living, good diet and exercise. Other ways are missing opportunities to promote Silver Sneakers, other wellness programs that are out there, whether it's a health coach or virtual care programs that exist. So to me, that's not something that we see all plan sponsors do, and I do think there's some opportunities there.
You mentioned the phrase earlier, value-based care. We hear it all the time. What does it actually mean in practical terms, and how is it different from traditional fee-for-service medicine?
And so instead of paying a fee-for-service, meaning when you go into your doctor, your health plan pays specifically for that visit, the model really is about in working directly with the provider or your physician to align around the clinical outcomes for that care, for the quality of care that receives and the preventative care that someone's receiving. So instead of it being about how many patients a provider can see, it's really about the quality of the care provided. So it helps with ensuring that the members are getting the most quality for the time that they're with that doctor. And so it's about access, coordination of care, and attention to prevention.
Can you kind of share an example of what success in that area might look like?
Absolutely. So what we see in the value-based care space is we see members that are diabetics engaging more readily to get their eye exams and their kidney care screening. We see better utilization of statin therapy for patients with cardiovascular disease, and we see improved medication adherence. When we also look at value-based care, compared to original Medicare, members that are engaged with the value-based care providers, we saw 24% fewer inpatient admissions. So because we know that the providers are actually working closely with the patients, there is less admissions to the hospital. We also have seen a 26% reduction in medical costs for plan sponsors compared to original Medicare, for those that are working with value-based care providers.
That's a big delta.
Yeah, absolutely. There's definitely a benefit to it.
We touched earlier on prevention. It's not really always exciting, but it can have a huge financial impact. Why is preventive care so important?
So preventative care is about diagnosis earlier. Right. So we want to do the screenings. So if there is something wrong, we catch it earlier on and prevent escalation or a worse diagnosis. One, it's help better for our members, and two, it reduces the cost. So what we'd like to do is screen people for diabetes, manage diabetes better, and screen for cancers more appropriately, so that we prevent disease progression and we improve long-term health and well-being of our members.
Another huge driver for everybody on every kind of plan is prescription drugs. It seems like it's a never-ending spiral up. Are there any practical strategies that group Medicare plans can use to better manage those costs?
Yeah, some of the issues in the prescription drug space are really just driven by specialty drugs and high-cost chronic disease therapies. And what I would say, there are about four pharmacy strategies that help manage cost in this space. One, when you're looking at managing in the pharmacy space, you want to look at maximizing the pharmacy value for the members. So can we appropriately promote generics and biosimilars, or educate members on lower cost alternatives so that they can afford those medications? So that's number one. Number two is focus not only on not just on the lowest price of the medication, but the lowest net cost of a medication, because we want to look at the total value that includes any pharmacy rebates, any discounts, or any promotions that the pharmaceutical companies have that will actually reduce that burden on the member. The third is really making sure that we're utilizing evidence-based medicine when we're evaluating the utilization of pharmacy therapies. So are we looking at step therapy appropriately, prior authorizations appropriately? We want to make sure that the members are receiving the right medication at the right time. And another one is just managing the formularies real well, prioritizing generics, biosimilars, and preferred therapies. One of the benefits to the members is ensuring that they're not on multiple medications within the same family. And this is something that's very common when members come out of the hospital, where the hospital switched their cholesterol medication to one that's on the hospital formulary, and then they leave there, and now they've got maybe two cholesterol medications or two blood pressure medications in the same family, and that can be very dangerous. So having that medication therapy management program to ensure that the members are safely taking the medications is very important.
That would obviously involve physicians and primary care, I guess, but are there other things that physicians can do to help control pharmacy spending?
Yeah, look for generic alternatives, and look for programs, work with the health plan to work for pharmacy discount programs. There's also diabetic supply programs where you can get diabetic testing supplies at no cost for the members. CenterWell Pharmacy offers that. And then there's patient assistance programs that are offered as well, where we will help members get financial resources to manage the treatment that they need. And that's important to do. Just one more point regarding the medication therapy management program. We actually work, our case managers and pharmacists work to do that to help members stay healthy when they leave the hospital.
And we do encourage folks to follow up with their primary care physician. So it's a dual effort.
So when organizations adopt those strategies, where do the savings actually show up?
So they show up in the members' pockets, less out-of-pocket costs for the members. They also show up in reduced costs for the plan sponsor. So if we can manage the formulary well, ensure that we're treating the members appropriately, and we're following those four things to manage pharmacy spend, it does reduce the cost burden for really everyone involved, the plan sponsor, the health plan, and the member.
We've seen a tremendous amount of growth. I think some of it may have started around COVID in virtual care. How does expanding access affect both quality and cost?
So
virtual care has reduced healthcare costs by providing care really in the lowest cost setting. It helps prevent unnecessary emergency visits, emergency room visits, and it can reduce hospital readmissions. It really is about meeting the patient where they are. And one of the ways that virtual care is really proven out is managing chronic conditions, where someone does need that routine follow-up, but they don't, maybe they have issues getting to the office, maybe it's transportation, maybe it's mobility challenges, but so that virtual care can fill in between visits and ensure that the member's getting the care that they need and the additional consultation and education that they need to stay healthy at home.
Chronic conditions and multiple chronic conditions are endemic to this population. Are there any particular strategies around those? We touched a little bit on watching about confusion with drugs or duplicate drugs. Anything else that's possible in that population?
Yeah, we've really made a lot of headway in the virtual care space. So now we have opportunities for members to receive care in multiple things in the virtual care space. One is musculoskeletal conditions. We offer virtual musculoskeletal programs where you can actually get evaluated by a physician, receive virtual physical therapy, a health coach, and a personalized care in the home. We offer cardiovascular programs, kidney care programs virtually for those that have advanced kidney care disease or maybe even on the road to dialysis or receiving dialysis. We also, behavioral health has gotten a lot of traction in the virtual care space. It's one of the areas where you have that home flexibility to get that appointment and get services quicker. And so virtual behavioral health is also an area where you've seen a lot of expansion and a lot of people more likely to engage because they can do that in the comfort of their own home.
You touched on musculoskeletal. I know a couple of years ago, that was the big driver of a lot of claims. Has that simmered down or is it still driving a tremendous amount of claims volume?
Musculoskeletal does drive a significant amount of procedures. And so one of the things that we are trying to do with our virtual musculoskeletal program is ensure that members have access to physical therapy and that specialized care with an orthopedic doctor virtually. And if they need surgery, we support them through that. But if it's something that where they can avoid surgery or avoid long-term pain medications and find ways to feel better without a surgical alternative, we try to support that where appropriate.
Is there anything that surprised you most about how patients use virtual care?
I'm surprised sometimes about how some of the folks that are, you would think are not tech savvy, actually pick it up and do great with it. They love it. They like to engage. They like the interaction that they get with the virtual care team. They like the consistency of the person that they're talking to. And the feedback and the net promoter scores are amazing in this space.
Well, it keeps them in their own environment, and that's, speaking as part of that cohort, it's something that we all want. And I think it's a particular baby boomer thing, but we love to be able to do stuff without leaving the house or without having to, get up and drive across town or get a ride across town if you're unable to drive any longer. So that's not totally surprising, but it certainly is great to hear. Are there any changes, that are being discussed at CMS or things that you'd like to see that you think might be helpful in terms of medical care and medical spend?
I don't think I'm a policy expert, David, but I can tell you that I think CMS is really looking at how do we continue to drive care into the home and support that. So I think the innovation side of CMS is ensuring that care can be delivered in really the most comfortable setting for our senior population. And so that's encouraging news for not only our retiree business, but just our aging population as a whole. And I hope that CMS continues to prioritize that in the work that they're doing.
Do you think a lot of that's going to be a tech play? Going to be devices that we have in the home? I mean, years ago, a friend of mine in California came up with a pregnant mouse that could read all kinds of vital signals and vital signs and all that stuff. Do you think that that's kind of the direction that a lot of that ability to stay in the home and get care is going to take?
I think so. And there is new tech coming out all the time. You know, there's wearable devices that folks can wear. Like, you've got these wearable rings, and we've got wearable heart monitors, and wearable watches aren't new. So I think there's a lot of additional monitoring that can go on for those that are comfortable with tech and are willing to take the time to learn it. A lot of the virtual care partners that we work with will actually provide the tech for the retiree so that they have, and then they teach you how to use it, which is fantastic. So it really just eliminates the need to go out and make that purchase as well.
That's awesome. And it kind of contributes to the primary care stuff as well. If you know, as we get more sophisticated and the data is available to physicians, you'll be able to spot small changes before they become big problems. And that's awesome too. Whereas, you know, somebody might, let's say a random male who's 73 might wait until they're really sick because, you know, we're guys and that's kind of what we do. And this way, if there's telemetry coming from the home on a real-time basis, you know, their physicians could set whatever thresholds they want for notifications. I don't think that's too, I think some of it's happening now, isn't it?
Yes, it is. Yes, and we've been able to manage some disease entities like congestive heart failure in the home with just monitoring of weight and vital signs. And those are wearables, as well as just having somebody get on the scale and then being able to call them and say, hey, you're up a pound today, you know, cut back your sodium, less fluids today, to really help manage that disease closer. Because what happens is when somebody's not watching, they're just more likely to end up with some fluid overload and in the hospital. So there's a lot of wonderful work going on in this space.
I think if my scale starts talking to my doctor, I'm in big trouble. Looking ahead, what advice would you give benefits advisors who want to help their group Medicare clients prepare for the future?
I would say think big and think long term, and partner with plans that are going to support that. There are and ask the questions about, you know, how are you investing in the future for retirees? How are you supporting programs related to cost, and how are you getting creative in that space? I think that's very important to ask. And then also ask for the data. Ask for the utilization data. Get a hold of the data so that you're able to best guide the plan sponsors with what's really been going on. So there should be data to support the programs that your retirees have been a part of. And it's perfectly appropriate to request that information so that everybody's on the same page and can support a long-term relationship.
So as we wrap up here, if listeners remember just one thing from our conversation today, what should it be?
I think I would say that healthcare is evolving quickly and that we have to consistently evolve with it. And we've got to think long-term, and we've got to think about how do we promote health and prevention and wellness for the retirees. And that is going to look different next year, and it'll look different the following year. And so ask questions about innovation and ask questions about how folks are really thinking about how to support long-term health and well-being and how they're supporting preventative care for the retirees.
Dr. Rebecca Colon, thank you for joining us on the Benefits Brief.
Thank you so much, David. I appreciate your time.
And thanks to all of you for listening. I'm David Saltzman, and until next time, you've been briefed.
Stay ahead with the Benefits Brief. Subscribe on Apple Podcasts or Spotify, or catch every episode in your member-exclusive Washington Update each Friday. To learn more about how NABIP helps you succeed, or to become a member, visit NABIP.org. That's NABIP.org.